again. Casual Friday around here, apparently. We will start the committee meeting today by opening a work session on Senate Bill 208 for the purpose of moving this to the April 14th meeting. This is the bill that will probably be moved to meeting after meeting till the end of the session. But at this point, I hope to finish work on it on April 14th, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 208. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 39. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 39 would require the trial court to determine on the record the mental disease or defect that was established as a basis for a guilty except for insanity plea. We heard this bill together with a companion bill, Senate Bill 41, on January 18th, and these were brought to us by the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And since the time of that hearing, there was a work group that gathered to discuss some technical changes to this bill, and then as well as incorporating the content of Senate Bill 41. So what we have before us now is a -1 amendment that makes a technical change to Senate Bill 39. Instead of requiring the court to find, and the word is find on the record, the mental disease or defect from which the defendant suffered or relied upon for the guilty except for insanity defense, the trial court will only be required to state, that is, rather than find, the mental disease or defect. The Oregon Judicial Department felt that the find language put their judges in a position where it may be inferred that they were making diagnoses that they're not qualified to do. Then the -3 amendment incorporates the substance of Senate Bill 41 into this measure, and what the -3 amendment does is make clear that if a defendant has successfully asserted the GEI defense, before the trial court makes the separate determination as to whether or not the defendant is going to be committed to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, it must order a psychological evaluation of the defendant, but only in those very rare cases where no such evaluation was already performed and provided to the trial court. The purpose of both of these provisions as encompassed in Senate and now what will be amended Bill 39 if it's passed is to better ensure that individuals who are placed within the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board are actually the types of folks that are supposed to be placed within the jurisdiction of the PSRB. And Mary Claire Buckley from the PSRB is present here too if there are any additional questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? We do have the Psychiatric Security Review Board present if there are questions. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see under Senate Bill 41, the staff measure summary shows no fiscal impact, but I find that odd because I would assume that many of these defendants would be people who are have injured in defense, and if they have to pay for a psychiatric review prior to claiming that defense, it seems like there would be a fiscal involved with that.
Maybe we could ask Ms. Buckley to come up and comment on that. I think I know the answer, but it's always better to have an expert. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. From the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Review Board. Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the reason that there isn't much of a fiscal impact on this is that these evaluations in almost all cases are already done. We're just trying to make sure that in every case, in a few isolated instances, we've had persons placed under the board without having an evaluation done prior to that, and so we're just trying to make sure, as counsel indicated, that all persons placed on the board would have that evaluation prior to, but we expect it's only very few cases that don't have that done at this time.
Madam Chair, can we get a definition of what a very few is and give you the scope of the problem here that we're trying to fix?
Do you have a kind of a ballpark estimate of, you know, maybe...
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, in the... I did go through sampling of the cases that we had received over the past couple of years, and there were only two or three in last year out of the 126 new cases we received that didn't have some kind of evaluation done. They may have relied on an assist eval or some other assessment, but there were only a handful of cases in the past couple of years that didn't have any assessment at all.
Counsel, we don't have a subsequent referral of any kind or any fiscal notation in the file. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Senator Byer, does that resolve your concerns?
Yeah, I just, what was that? Two out of three cases out of how many was? What was the big number? I didn't get it.
I'm sorry. In 2003, we received 110 new clients, and only one or two of those did not have a current evaluation. And in 2004, we received 126 new cases, and there was one with nothing, with no evaluation at all, and a couple that had questionable evals from other parties, or not by professional psychologists or psychiatrists, maybe used a case manager, what have you. So I would say probably three or four at the most in 2004 out of the 126 new cases.
Okay. Thank you for your question. That's a good point to get cleared up. Okay, is there any other questions or discussion? Senator Starr, we have a dash one and a dash three amendment to Senate Bill 39.
We need both of those.
That's correct. The purpose of the dash one is to make a technical change, and the purpose of the dash three is to incorporate Senate Bill 41 into Senate Bill 39.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 39.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 39. Is there a discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 39.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 39. Is there a discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Yes, I move Senate Bill 39 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 39 to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Objection? So ordered. Anybody want to carry this? Senator Pruszynski would like this bill. And now he has it. Senator Pruszynski will carry this bill. Thank you very much. For the record, Senator Pruszynski is carrying
it. I'm on the hook.
Okay. Okay, thanks. All right. Next, we will.
Ma'am, can we close that work session already?
We have. Senator Barr, would you like to open it with unanimous consent? Can we open it?
Yeah, I guess I do have a question about dash three I just caught.
Okay, with unanimous consent, we will reopen the work session on Senate Bill 39.
Just a question for counsel. Senate Bill 41 is amending ORS 161-309. The amendments in the Senate Bill 39 amend ORS 161-327. Would you like to comment on how that is the same thing?
It's not exactly the same thing. It was a product of the work group, the majority of the consensus among the work group, which was, let me take you back to the objection that was raised at the public hearing to Senate Bill 41. The concern that was lodged on behalf of the ACLU and I believe the SDLA was that they saw Senate Bill 41 as changing the current rule as to when or whether a psychological evaluation is to be provided to the court by a defendant who is asserting the guilty except for insanity defense. And the purpose of the work group was to rework the language of 41 to make it so that if no evaluation had been performed, that the evaluation would have to be performed post-adjudication, that is, after the court made a determination or the jury, in very rare cases, that the person successfully asserted the guilty except for insanity defense. So in light of that person, of that purpose, members of the work group felt that the operative language made more sense in this other statute, which is the content of the dash 3 to Senate Bill 39, which is the statute that governs what the court is to do after the GEI adjudication. And the court first makes a determination as to whether or not the individual defendant is going to be committed to the PSRB, and that requires certain findings. And we insert, the work group decided to insert the language about requiring the report in that portion of the statute because it was the part of the statute that talks about what the court does immediately post-adjudication but before commitment to the PSRB. And there are some cases, they're relatively few, but low-level cases where the court determines that a person doesn't need to go to the PSRB and discharges the defendant. In those cases, I think the group thought it made sense to not require an evaluation to be done if one hadn't been done already because the court's not doing anything with this person, just discharging them.
So what this is now doing is it does have nothing to do with actually the trial of the person on their whether or not their criminal or reason for insanity or guilty except for insanity.
I think that's accurate. I don't think it does have an effect on the trial itself. The procedure for a guilty except for insanity trial, I think, remains completely unchanged by these measures.
So who's going to do the and pay for? I mean, if this person is found guilty and is on his way to the psychiatric review board, I guess the word is, who's going to do and or pay for this psychological evaluation now? It's no longer an indigent defense issue.
It actually, the work group considered that issue, and in page 1 of the dash 3 at line 21, decided to insert subparagraph B to that statute that governs the issue of how the court is to dispose of someone who successfully asserts the GEI defense. And under that section, if the court is ordering the person committed to the PSRB and determines that there's been no prior psychological evaluation, the court orders it and has to determine if the person is financially eligible, and if they are, then it is paid for by public defense services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Does that resolve your concerns? Thank you. We will reclose the work session on Senate Bill 39, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 216. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 216 comes to you from the Department of Justice. This measure would allow the Attorney General to make a claim for recovery on behalf of class members, that is, in a class action lawsuit, who failed to submit claims regarding monetary judgments that result in the class action lawsuit. It permits the Attorney General to make disbursements from those monies based on the terms of the class action judgment. There are two amendments in your packet to this measure. Both of them concern the disposition of any funds that are considered unclaimed property from a class action. I should back up for 1 second and describe that under Oregon law, Rule of Civil Procedure 32F requires the claimants in a class action to submit a statement in order to be eligible to receive any monetary damages. If the court determines that there are more claimants who have not submitted the necessary statement, then the remainder money judgment is reverted back to the defendant. And what this measure does is, instead of that remainder reverting back to the defendant, it would assign those funds to the Attorney General. Under the Dash 1 amendment, the Attorney General would treat those funds as unclaimed property, and once the prescribed waiting period of time has expired, that amount of money would be diverted to the Common School Fund. Then the Dash 2 amendment is an alternative that would require the Attorney General to distribute one half of any of these unclaimed amounts to the Common School Fund and the other half to the Consumer Protection Education Revolving Account.
Okay. We have Fred Boss and Kevin Neely here. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Brodick, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss, and I am an Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 216. Under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, in a class action where the defendant has been found liable and has been ordered to pay a certain amount of money, the individual class members are required to submit individual claims. Historically, the response of the class members is less than 50%. The remaining money is then returned to the defendant that has already been found liable. This is a windfall for that defendant. Senate Bill 216 amends the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure 32F2 and gives the Attorney General the specific authority to intervene to file a claim for those unclaimed funds and to take those funds and to distribute them under the Cypre Doctrine according to the terms of the judgment that is entered by the court. So rather than the funds reverting to the defendant, who has already been found liable and then found liable for a certain amount of money, those funds are then used for a public purpose. Our Dash 1 amendment treats those funds as unclaimed property, so that if there are claimants that wish to come and submit their claim after the prescribed period of time, they can recover their money. Unclaimed property, the interest does go to the Common School Fund, and it does ultimately revert to the Common School Fund. The Dash 2 amendments direct half of the unclaimed property to be treated as unclaimed property, half the funds to be treated as unclaimed property, and the other half to go to the Consumer Protection and Education Revolving Account. This is an account that, up until the last session, did receive general funds from the legislature, but those general funds were suspended for this for the last biennium. It's something that the Attorney General and this legislature have struggled because these are the funds that are used to, in part, finance the Attorney General's consumer protection account or consumer protection work group. The type of recovery that I'm talking about is generally allowed under the Civil Rules of Procedure and the 36 states which have adopted the federal rules. Other states, such as California and Iowa, have adopted similar programs in which the unclaimed funds do revert to the state, in California, I believe, to the state legislature for disbursement. In our research, Oregon and New Hampshire are the only states which allow the unclaimed property or the unclaimed funds to go back to the tortfeasor. I want to also point out that this is applicable only in cases that have gone to trial and not in cases that have settled out. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 216 and would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Could you tell us what Cypre means?
I don't know, Chiberlick, I don't know the exact definition. It is for the public purpose. This is the literal definition. We're going to find out about
that. We have a Black's Law Dictionary here, Madam Chair.
That's right here.
Put in here about two sessions back. Just for that reason.
Is it defined? It's written on the bottom of the SNS.
Oh,
Joe.
Oh, so it is. It means as near as possible. It's actually French, kind of derivative.
It's nice to have counsel already thinking our questions before we get there.
So French, Madam Chair.
Well, I thought I did too.
But apparently not. French.
Okay. So you're saying that only two states allow the unrecovered settlements or the unrecovered money to go back to the tortfeasor?
Sure, that is correct in our research of the matter.
Okay, and would you differentiate between us, for us, what would happen to settlement money? You said that this would only apply to cases that went to court, but not to settlements?
Chiberti, that is correct. Settlements are agreements between the parties, mm-hmm. and the parties can generally settle however they wish. In a class action, the settlements do have to be approved by a court. And the court is generally overseen to make sure that the attorney's fees are not too much and that the class is being treated fairly. This procedure would amend the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, or this bill would amend the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure that specifically apply to a class action where the judgment has been entered, and so one that has gone through trial, a judgment has been entered against the defendant, and a specific amount has been found that the defendant is liable, and then we're into this would address the claims process after the finding, after the judgment.
Okay, but in a settlement, there has to be some way. Wouldn't there be unclaimed funds in a settlement too?
So, Burdick, those are usually handled by agreement, and the parties reach an agreement on how to handle the unclaimed funds.
So, I guess what I'm trying to get at, is it possible that settlement funds would go back to the company that had the action against it?
It is possible. It is subject to the agreement between the two parties, the representatives for the defendant and the representatives for the class, to reach an agreement.
Well, so if they reach an agreement that the company has to bungle up $10 million through some process,
mm-hmm.
and that process only results in $5 million in claims, then what would happen in the case of a settlement, or is this even analogous?
They would address that as a matter of contract between the two parties. So they certainly could. They could say that unclaimed amount does go back to the defendant. That unclaimed amount goes to a fund of some form for future claimants. That the claimants who have made claims have increased their amount of their claim. There could be all sorts. A variety by contract that the individual parties, a variety of solutions to this particular problem. So the answer is yes, that is potentially one of the solutions that would happen by agreement between the parties.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a question?
I do, Madam Chair. The type of class actions, the underlying suits, what type of suits are we looking at that would be brought that this could apply to?
Chiburdick, Senator, when we've taken a view at some of these cases, they can be generally products liability cases. There's one presently, Strong versus Allstate, I believe it is a class breach of contract for insurance agents. So it would be any type of class action. Those, in my experience, have generally been products liability, but they can be contracts such as the Allstate case.
Consumer-oriented type of claims that involved a large number of people. I just want to put some stuff on the record because what I want to do is ask on the dash ones versus the dash twos, half the award on the dash two would go to the Consumer Protection Education Revolving Account. That account is used for what purpose?
That account is used to fund the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Program.
So the program itself, the unit that's within the DOJ that deals with consumer protection and actions or fraud cases. Madam Chair, one other question.
Please.
And just for the record again, if you have a plaintiff who is not part of any class action, what remedies do they have if they learn of this action after it has been completed? It would seem to me that they may have their own suit if they start within the statute of limitations that they could bring, or can they somehow tie into whatever the class action settlement if a judge, I guess on the record, said that all the members have not been located?
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski. My understanding of the Oregon class action statute is that it is a double opt-out statute. So a class action is commenced, and assuming that a person is a putative class member, a potential part of this class, then they do have a claim.
At a certain point in time, they'll receive notice of the class, and they'll have the opportunity to opt out of the class action and have their own separate individual lawsuit. If they don't opt out within a certain prescribed period of time, then they are in the class action, assume it's a tort, their tort falls within the prescribed period of time and type. Then the class action proceeds, it proceeds to trial, and then proceeds to a judgment. Then there is, in essence, another opt-in in which that class member files a claim in order to receive a distribution from the funds. Under the, so that is the way it works now. Under the dash one and the dash two, potentially the period of time for that putative class member that has not opted out of the class to come and make a claim for the funds has been extended, in that it will be treated as the funds will be treated as unclaimed property. Presently, unclaimed property in Oregon, I believe individual has a period of time to 25 years to make a claim against the funds and division of state lands, and then receive their portion. Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, I've talked to several people about it. Somebody told me that there was no deadline on the unclaimed property.
Chair Burley, quite honestly, I'm not sure. As I have not researched that, and I'd be pleased to do so and put it
to you. Well, because with the dash two amendment, if you put it in the unclaimed property, half in the unclaimed property and then half in the Attorney General's revolving fund, and then more than half of the claimants actually filed for the unclaimed property, then what would happen? Because the money wouldn't be there, it'd be at the Attorney General's office.
Correct. Jabuti, correct. And that would be a potential problem there. Historically, we don't think that would be a problem, but potentially, if one half of the potential claimants that did not make a claim went and further made the claim, then it would put stress on the unclaimed property fund.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, sure. Senator
Krasanski. So I'm assuming, Mr. Voss, the theory is that at this point, based on previous class actions, the number of people, let's say, evolved or shown up after the fact, your best guesstimate is that we wouldn't reach the problem if we took the dash twos, because there are not that many people coming forward that's going to get to half, even though in theory it's a possibility.
Chair Burdick, Senator Krasanski. Yes.
Okay. All right. Mr. Neely, did you want to speak on this?
For the record, Kevin Neely, Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers. I think that the only thing I would add, Chair Burdick, is that the number of cases affected by this law is a very small number. Virtually all of these cases do, in fact, settle. So far as we can tell, in what I would admit is very preliminary research, it appears in the past two decades there are maybe seven or eight cases that will be affected. But I think it's important to remember, in those seven or eight cases, we are generally talking about millions and millions of dollars, so far as I can tell. We've identified about $3 million that would be affected by this change in the law.
Dollars in unclaimed?
$3 million in unclaimed verdicts through that claims process.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The deletion of language on page 3 of the bill leads me to believe that when the judges or the juries or whatever, when they are trying to determine the size of the award, they base it on so much per individual class member. Is that correct?
Senator Beyer, yes.
So, Madam Chair, if the judge or the jury or in this case the Attorney General has overestimated the number of class members out there and people don't feel they've been harmed, and the judgment is based on so much per class member, why should we be penalizing a company for harm they didn't actually commit?
I think that goes beyond the. Well, you could go ahead and answer
that. Senator, the that is part of the litigation process, and the plaintiff's counsel will say will establish how many members of the potential class are out there, and then the class counsel will also provide the average damage per class member. That's part of the litigation process. The defendants have an ample opportunity to go up and say, number one, there aren't that many class members, and no, the damages are not that amount. That is fully litigated to a trier of fact who then comes back and makes a decision. And then they'll make a decision that the amount of damages is X. Under our current process, then the claimants, it's up to the claimants to come forward and claim their portion of X.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. My question is, if the overestimation of X, and that is how many claimants there should be, and the damages, let's say there was supposed to be 3,000 claimants and each one was harmed by $1,000, that's $3 million class action settlement, but if only 500 claimants come forward, that means that they overestimated the people, the number of people who thought that they were damaged. Why should a company be penalized then to pay an extra $1.5 million for people who weren't damaged?
Well, but I think the thought behind this is that by requiring an affirmative action on the part of the people who are damaged, some of them just don't apply. They don't send in the coupon to get what they're entitled to.
Because they don't feel they've been damaged.
So, well, they could not feel they're damaged, or they might recycle their mail aggressively, or, you know, any number of things. But the question is, who should get that money? I mean, the amount of the award is really outside the scope of this bill. Is that correct?
I did talk to one of the major claims companies is located here in Oregon, and I did have an opportunity to talk to them, and I asked them what's the range of claims that we see in these cases, and they told me that they range from under 10% all the way up to 90%. And the factors that they indicated to me were key factors in identifying how many claims came in was obviously the size of the claim. In some instances, the claim may be for a very, very small amount, and the class size may be gargantuan. And in those instances, the likelihood of a high percentage of claims coming in is much lower because the incentive to file a claim for $1.50 isn't there. Whereas if you have a case where there is $10 or $12 per claimant, the incentive there is much higher. So I think that, again, as Mr. Boss indicated, the courts adjudicate the actual number of claimants that are eligible to receive part of the settlement or the, in this case, damages. And at the end of the day, it's really the terms of that monetary damage that in large part drives the number of claimants, and that number varies tremendously. But as Mr. Boss also indicated, the average, is, so far as we can tell, is about half the claimants coming in these cases. And I don't think that fully answers your question, Senator Beyer, but...
Well, no, it doesn't. And, Madam Chair, I guess I would argue that if the amount of the award is what is at issue here, rather than give the money to the Common School Fund and the Attorney General, or the Common School Fund, the Consumer Protection Education Evolving Fund, and the Attorney General, you should increase the amount that each of the people who did claim it get. If because those are the people who feel they've been hurt by the actions of a company or whoever the defendant is,
The approach of putting it in the unclaimed, I mean, the decision whether to put some in the revolving fund is separate, but the rationale of putting in the unclaimed property fund is people would have 25 years to discover that they had a claim and go after it. It would be their right to file a claim would be preserved rather than giving the money to other claimants.
I appreciate that.
I think that was the rationale toward putting it in the fund. The policy issue of giving part of it to the consumer protection is different. Okay, are there other questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Senator Burdick, thank you. I'm struggling with the same thing that Senator Byers is struggling with here, how you can have unclaimed property for a claimant who never made a claim. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, that I struggle with that. And then it would seem that this process would really favor a plaintiff attorney, or in the case of it was an attorney general being a plaintiff attorney, that they would really benefit from overstating the size of the class in order to create a windfall for the state, or in the case of an attorney general, or in the case of the plaintiff, for the more the larger the class, the bigger his share of the pie is. It's just there's just something about the process that doesn't seem equitable to me.
Thank you. Comment.
That was an editorial, not a question.
Okay, thank you.
Is that correct? Or is
Are there
that
other
correct?
Questions from the committee or comments or editorial comments? Thank you very much. Okay, now we have Jim Gardner and Julie Brandis signed up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for variety of business entities that I represent, Microsoft, Pharma, Philip Morris, and others. And I want to begin by drawing your attention to a piece of legislation which is not directly at issue in the sense of being amended by this bill, but is highly relevant to the topic under consideration, and that is the organic statute for the Council on Court Procedures, which appears at ORS 1.725 at SEC. And those of you who are longtime observers of this process may recall or may have learned that that was an entity that was created in 1977 for the express purpose of conducting systematic review and analysis of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, one of which this bill proposes to amend. And the reason that the legislature did that in 1977 was to essentially enlist an expert group of lawyers and judges. The predominant group of people on that body are circuit court judges, who would undertake a thorough, systematic, non-piecemeal approach to looking at the rules of civil procedure, this particular rule among them, and bring the benefit of their expertise and experience to bear in terms of trying to correct problems and address issues that have arisen. It may also interest you to know that there is currently a process underway to consider an amendment to ORCP 32, the very rule that is the subject of this bill. I happen to know that because I have been, on behalf of a good swath of the business community, been interacting with the council, and am still attempting to see if there is any potential common ground that could be reached to address some of the issues that arise under this claim form provision. The proposal that was put forward initially by the plaintiff's side, we felt, went too far. The council voted not to go that direction, but has essentially opened a dialogue into whether or not there might be some common ground for addressing the so-called possibility of Cypre recovery, which is what we've discussed. I have to tell you that the bill before you, and particularly the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, are a giant leap beyond what anyone has considered or proposed at the Council on Court Procedures, and even beyond what I think a fair reading of the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, the analogous rule, would do. These bills essentially abrogate the long-standing rule that the total award of damages in a class action of monetary damages shall not exceed the arithmetic total of the claim forms. That has been a principle in Oregon law that has been in existence for as long as there has been a class action procedure. It's a fundamental element of our law. And there are instances in which it might be in the interests of both sides, as is the case in federal court, to agree to a so-called cypre recovery. For instance, if the amount of each claim is very small, there might be instances where you would agree that that money should go for a charitable purpose that would be related to the nature of the claim, an educational endowment or something like that. But that's by agreement of the parties. This bill, as currently written and with the dash one and dash two amendments, would present severe constitutional problems. And that's not just Jim Gardner's viewpoint. That is the language which I'm going to read to you, Madam Chair, with your permission, in a 1981 opinion issued by the Attorney General. Here's what it says. We recognize due process claims which a defendant may make if denied the opportunity to confront and cross-examine each plaintiff and challenge the validity of individual damage claims. These considerations undoubtedly contributed to the legislature's decision to preclude fluid recovery by the enactment of a prior bill. And it cites a Oregon Supreme Court case, Bernard versus First National Bank. Well, that issue is presented squarely by this bill, because one of the benefits of the claim form requirement is that the defendant, in fact, gets to test the proposition that this particular defendant has a claim in the amount he or she says exists. You get to test that. You get to cross-examine. You get to challenge the assertion of facts that are made in the claim form. The other potential defect of this, because this bill does not change another provision that I'm going to read to you. It appears on page 3 of your bill, lines 34 through 36, and I'll just read that for your convenience. Failure of a class member to file a statement required by the court will be grounds for entry of judgment dismissing such class member's claim for individual monetary recovery without prejudice to the right to maintain an individual but not a class action for such claims. In other words, for as long as the statute of limitations continues to run, the individual who does not file the claim form has a right of action against the defendant. So what happens if the money has already gone somewhere else, let's say half of it has gone to the Consumer Protection Fund, and we have these individual claims filed? Does the defendant pay twice? Because that provision remains in the statute, the one that I just read.
Just to hold you back a second, this is not, you know, the proposed Dash 1 amendment would put it in the unclaimed property fund where it would be available for someone to claim.
Madam Chair, I was referring to the Dash 2s.
Well, let's put those aside
okay.
for a minute. Let's deal with the Dash 1s, which would put it
in. And I agree that, yes, Madam Chair, that would attempt to address that particular issue. But eventually, this money, if not claimed, eventually reverts to the common school fund, to the state. And in that instance, you have an issue that's very close to what Senator Whitsitt, I think, was attempting to raise, where there's been no adjudication that this particular claim is owed in this amount to anyone. There's an estimate, but there's no adjudication.
Well, Mr. Boss from the Department of Justice said that in his testimony that only two states return the money to the company that was, you know, found liable in this circumstance. So based on what you're saying, Are you disputing that other states do it differently?
Madam Chair, no, other states do it differently, and that's precisely what we're working on at the Council on Court Procedures, to allow, at least by stipulation, Cypre recoveries in appropriate instances. Because Oregon has had this rule in effect for a long time, but we recognize that there may be a value in a dialogue about whether or not there should be some additional flexibility. But I wanted to also just correct one thing in the sense that the money reverting to the defendant, the money doesn't leave the hands of the defendant unless a claim is perfected. So it's not given back. It's simply that there is not a monetary claim asserted by a particular class member. But I think our basic position is that this is something, there's an ongoing examination of this at the Council on Court Procedure level, and that's really where it ought to be examined.
Well, you said this is a drastic departure from where they're going. What would you expect to come out of the Council on Court Procedure?
Perhaps, Madam Chair, something that would say that by stipulation, the parties in a judgment may provide for Cypre or fluid recovery.
By stipulation, that implies a settlement. This is a court decision.
No, Madam Chair, this would be post-judgment, a post-judgment agreement essentially to waive the claim form requirement.
So people wouldn't file claims at all?
That, Madam Chair, that would be one possibility. You could have, there have been cases in federal court, for instance, where a judgment was entered, but the amounts were very small individual amounts, pennies perhaps, and the parties have stipulated that the funds would go to a, for instance, a consumer education fund or something like that.
You'd still have Senator Byer's concern about maybe the class was too large.
Madam Chair, the issue of definition of the class, who's in it and who's out of it, is something that occurs at the outset of a class certification proceeding. So that's the sort of the upfront decision.
That's correct, and that's why, I mean, that's a separate decision. So at the end of the day, if you do have a claims procedure, is it really fair just to send back the money to the people who were assessed the money and let them pocket it rather than put it to some other use?
Well, Madam Chair, as I was mentioning before, it's not sent back to them because it's not a claim for that particular class member has never been fully adjudicated. We haven't gotten to the point, because they didn't file a claim form, that this person is owed $5, and because the defendant, because no claim form was ever perfected, so it's an element of completing the claim.
Yes, but you just said that the claim, the size and extent of damage of the class is determined at the beginning. So if you have a class that has been determined at the beginning and you make a monetary assessment, you don't say, these judgments, unless I'm wrong, don't say $5 per claim. They say $10 million.
Madam Chair, that will depend, but the provision in the rule that you're proposing to amend, in fact, limits the judgment, the aggregate judgment, to the arithmetic total of the claim forms. And if I may address what occurs up front in a class action is class certification, which is where you go in and argue that there's a commonality of facts and legal issues, and the members of the class are this population. So that's the thing that I was referring to, Madam Chair, that occurs up front.
But the award itself is a monetary award against the company that's to be divided up between members of the class. So they take the $10 million, they divide it by 5,000, which is how many people are in the class, and that's how much each person gets.
Madam Chair, that's not necessarily the case. There can be an award that will say, which is in this kind of instance is more typical, an award will say, each, let's say it's an antitrust overprice case. Each plaintiff who bought this widget is entitled to $5 rebate, then the amount of the award will be the arithmetic total. You can see it right in the...
You multiply the number of people affected by the amount of the damage, and you get to the end. I mean, you get to the final number.
Yeah, but, Madam Chair, the rule right now, as written, says that the... And it's echoed in this Attorney General's opinion, that the aggregate judgment, the final judgment against the defendant, is the arithmetic total of all the claim forms filed.
Right. And this would change the rule.
That's right.
The purpose of the bill.
Right.
Right. Because the Attorney General's office would argue that the rule is not fair because it determines what the amount of damages are, and then if not everybody files their claim, then what remains goes back to the company.
Or, Madam Chair, it never leaves the company.
Well, semantics.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's a judgment against the company.
Yes, I, and right now the safeguard for the non-filer is that the right of action is preserved. Their claim is dismissed without prejudice, but they can refile within the statute of limitations.
Right, and I just got a note that someone looked into how the unclaimed property fund works, and it has no statute of limitation. It goes on in perpetuity. So any member of the class, for as long as they live, could file a claim.
Now, there's another legal issue. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I think this is the kind of issue that lends itself to study and resolution by the Council on Court Procedures, and that process can take a long time. But there's an active docket essentially open on this, the reform of Rule 32 right now.
Well, you said that this organization has been in existence since 1977. They've
yes.
had 28 years to deal with this issue.
They have dealt with it on occasion before. The 1981 Attorney General's opinion was prompted by some proposed changes to it. But it's dealt with. It deals with the entire body of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, but not just this provision.
Okay. Are there other questions, Senator Prusansky?
Yeah, Jim. That's the Council on
Court Procedures.
Court Procedures.
Yeah, and it's the organic statute begins at ORS 1.725.
Do you know if they're actually looking at this component of the Rule 32 as it pertains specifically to what to do with the unclaimed awards?
They're looking at the, Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky, they are looking at the claim form requirement, Rule F2, and specifically at whether or not that ought to be discretionary with the trial judge and under what circumstances, so that it could be dispensed with in appropriate cases and a fluid or cypre recovery contemplated. And our view is that should be by agreement. The other's view of others is that it should be purely at the discretion of the trial judge. But it is this very provision of F2 that's being addressed.
The class action suits that are brought forward in this area, what I'm hearing your testimony is that if a judgment's rendered, the defendant does not have to tender that money to the court for distribution?
That's correct. That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky.
And they maintain the money until there's some... I guess walk me through that, Jim, because I'm not familiar with... how that works.
And Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky, I'm not anymore a class action litigator. So I will do the best I can with regard to that. The step that occurs after a determination of liability has been made, but prior to entry of a judgment against the defendant, under Rule 32F2, the all the members of the class receive what is called a claim form, and they're asked to fill this out, attesting to the nature of the loss or injury or claim that they have suffered, the damages they've suffered. They send that back in to the court. The defendant can challenge, cross-examine, dispute those claims, just like you would a regular claim for damages in a non-class case. But ultimately, the judge makes a determination of the as to the validity of those claims, and then a judgment is entered for an amount of recovery against the defendant, which is the arithmetic total of all the claim forms, and that's the judgment. And you can see it says prior under on line 22, page 3, prior to the entry of a judgment against a defendant, that all of this has to occur.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pisanski.
So once we know the class, let's say the class size is 5,000, they submit their forms, all 5,000 of them, then what I'm hearing, Mr. Gardner, is that the defendant in those cases would be able to challenge each and every one of those once the judge says, let's say 4,500 of them are valid claims. Is the judgment then being paid out by the defendant to each of the individual plaintiffs, or is it going in to some type of being deposited to the court to be paid out according to the order of the court?
Madam Chair, Senator Pisanski, that will depend on the to some degree on the individual judge's discretion. Frequently the money will go directly from the defendant to the class members, but there will be a some kind of an oversight mechanism to ensure that the money was actually paid and that the judgment was judgment obligation was met.
One other question.
Please.
And then on the statute of limitation question, not knowing exactly what the class action suit is, knowing that that means that the statute of limitations is going to vary anywhere from maybe 2 years up to, I guess, ultimate repose is what, 8 years?
It's Madam Chair, Senator Pisanski, it's a total now of, and we just changed that law last session, it's a total of 10 years with a 2-year discovery rule inside the 10.
So maybe up to 10 years, let's say thereabouts. I think the chair brings out a point which I was also thinking about, was that the money that is unclaimed, if it goes into unclaimed property, it's there into perpetuity, the principal, with the interest going into the common school fund. And it seems to me that if a person neglected or failed to file within the statute of limitations, they have no recourse except to go through whatever money has been set aside. And what I'm hearing is that if this money goes back to the defendant, there's never going to be any recourse because they've missed their time frame.
Madam Chair, Senator Pisanski, yes, if they've missed the statute of limitations or the statute of repose, they do not have a right of recovery.
Thank you.
So if, in worst case scenario, say you had, well, what would happen in reverse? If you had a $10 million judgment against you for 5,000 in the class and 6,000 people filed claims, what would be the responsibility of the company?
Well, Madam Chair, the responsibility of the company would be to pay out on the claim forms that were filed, and then after the non-claiming members of the plaintiff class had their actions dismissed without prejudice, it would be to respond to whatever individual judgments might be brought by them.
But that wasn't my question. If you had a class of 5,000 that had claims, and the class turned out to be larger than they thought, and 6,000 people send in their coupons for their $5.30, what would the company do then? Would they pay out all the claims?
Madam Chair, that's an interesting question. If the I don't know the answer to that question, Madam Chair, because it's I think that the that would mean that the class had been inappropriately defined or counted, essentially, at the outset. I don't know what the answer to that would be. My guess is that those claims would have to be paid. But I can't say that with certainty.
Yeah. Okay, are there other questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Ms. Brandis.
I'm Julie Brandis. I'm not going to try and sit here and argue the bills as it relates to court procedures and so on. One of the things that sort of triggered my interest in this legislation is the relation to the unclaimed property. And we feel very strongly at our organization, and I know Senator Prozanski has seen me huffing around the Capitol on another bill, and he's been very polite about the huffing, but the role of the unclaimed property is to unite customers or people or individuals with the money they are rightly due. And the Division of State Lands is to go out of their way to unite people with their money that they have earned or lost or whatever. And I'm not quite sure in this legislation how the AG is going to determine which class they feel is underrepresented or unrepresented in a case and notify that class that we have taken the ball up for you, and at some later point you might want to check with Division of State Lands. And further, how they are going to work with the Division of State Lands to make sure certain persons have been quote-unquote represented as a class in this case, and then trigger, in fact, turn them to the Division of State Lands to go get their rightfully earned money. Now, if the purpose of this legislation is to say this is a great way to make revenue for the Division of State Lands and the Unclaimed Property Act, and to, you know, create, you know, some money for Division of the Attorney General's Office, then this probably works. If the concept is to unite the people with their money, I'm not sure it's doing that. And that, I'm pretty sensitive to that, as I explained, because I've been huffing around on another piece of legislation. I take a look at one of my favorite cases that was a class action, and it had to do with collusion in department stores between the makeup counters. Now, don't ask me about why I know so much about this case, but there was evidently some collusion going on prices. And what ended up happening is people who had purchased products from either, I think, Lancome and MAC and one other, ended up getting a coupon to a local department stores that you could get some redemption from or buy new product or whatever the case might be. And that was probably the best way to go about it in that case, because the customers were reunited with some value at the company. So I always think about that case when I think about how would this really react, because there's no linkage between the class and getting that money.
Use your example just to break in for a second. If you were if you were overcharged, say, for a product, and then the company was found liable for overcharging you, and for whatever reason they didn't locate you for the coupon, so that you were not able to be reunited with your money, do you think it's fair that money goes back to the benefit of the company that deprived you in the first place?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're facing the same argument on the unclaimed gift cards. Yes, I do. I mean, I just don't see a problem with that. If you do not know you've been harmed, if you did not file, if you did not participate, you stand a better chance of getting value from the company that way than you do going to the Unclaimed Property Act, because the unclaimed property, the Division of State Lands, has no way to link you. And that's the exact same thing that's going on with the gift certificates. The store does not know that you are the store has a better understanding. If you walk in with a gift card, that you are some type of customer, whether 3 years has passed or not. So, yeah, I think it does serve a better value with the company than going into a fund that you're going to have to prove somehow that you're entitled to $5.25. And I think in this case, the Lancome and the MAC case, and I don't know if those were the actual companies, they did an excellent job of tracking down the customers. So that's my sensitivity on one part. I think I should bring up another sensitivity, which it has nothing to do with the class action, but it does have to do with the Attorney General's office in the state. And that has to do with some of the settlements that came out of probably unfair trade practices in the... electricity cases where the electricity rates went up, for example, the Williams settlement, we had to fight. The customers in the state had to fight to get some of that money back. That we know who pays higher energy prices. It's not rocket science. It's the customers. And when the settlement, when the AG's office settled on that, and again, it wasn't a class action suit, and I understand that, and it's different, we had to go through rocks at Hardy's Myers Windows, you know, here over here at AOI, just across the street, and say, look, you're forgetting it's not just the Energy Trust who deserves the money, or low-income, recipients, people who need low-income billet paying assistance, it's the customers. And so I do think there's not quite a linkage of how you're going, again, to get who deserves the money and how you make that link to the state.
Senator Pazansky.
Mr. Gardner, a couple of questions that came to mind. The Council on Court Procedure, who makes that up? Who's part of that council?
Madam Chair, Senator Pazansky, it's defined by statute. Can I just read it to you? Okay. One judge of the Supreme Court, chosen by the Supreme Court, one judge of the Court of Appeals, chosen by the Court of Appeals, eight judges of the Circuit Court, chosen by the Executive Committee of the Circuit Judges Association, 12 members of the Oregon State Bar, appointed by the Board of Governors, and then it specifies the Board of Governors in making the appointments shall include, but not be limited to, appointments for members of the Bar active in civil trial practice to the end that the lawyer members of the Council shall be broadly representative of the trial bar and the regions of the state. And translated, that means they try to have a pretty even balance between plaintiff and defense side.
Right. Without a representative, sir.
You want to follow up?
Yeah, the F2 question, how long has that been before the council?
Madam Chair, Senator Pazansky, it is the council meets during the interim, and it was a project for last interim. I'm not sure when the docket was opened. I became involved in the fall, the way that this statute works is the council considers various changes to the rules during a particular interim, and then it will promulgate a rule change, almost like enacting legislation, and unless the legislature affirmatively undoes it, it becomes part of the rules of civil procedure. So this one, to my knowledge, this particular issue was open sometime during the last interim and is continuing.
Lastly, do you know when they are scheduled to reach whatever conclusion they're going to reach to see if they're going to actually amend the rule?
Madam Chair, Senator Pazansky, I do not. I would anticipate it would be after adjournment because of this session, because they do have some other rule changes which they have adopted, which they will be essentially at some point before this committee defending, if you haven't heard from them already, this committee and the House committee.
Thank you. Other questions? We're going to close the hearing on this bill, 216. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 422. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 422 would allow a person subject to a stalking protective order to seek dismissal of such an order. Under current law, a stalking protective order does not have an ending point. And this statute would create a process by which the respondent of a stalking protective order could petition the court for dismissal. A show cause hearing would be set, at which time the respondent, a hearing would be set on that motion and would have to be set on that motion within 21 days after filing the motion to dismiss. And at that hearing, the court would have to dismiss the stalking protective order if it found that there had been no repeated acts of unwanted contact and that the person protected by the order does not have a reasonable basis to fear further acts of unwanted contact.
Thank you. Speaking for this bill are Mark Kramer and looks like Laura Grazer. signed up in favor of this bill?
Yes.
Okay. You have to wait. You're in favor? Okay. up you go.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Mark Kramer. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland with a focus on family law. In 1987, I was co-counsel to this committee. Because stalking and domestic violence are sensitive issues, I want you to know that 60% of my caseload are women, that I regularly represent victims of domestic violence, and that I have successfully sued perpetrators of domestic violence. This is not a pro-stalking bill, nor does it unfairly burden stalking victims. It is about fairness and due process. The origin of this bill lies in a recent Clackamas County case. I represented a gentleman, Jonathan Beeler. In 1999, he didn't contest the issuance of a stalking order against or on behalf of his former girlfriend. He had admitted to repeated and unwanted contact with his former girlfriend, and he had scratched her car with his key. He was convicted of criminal mischief, and he was sentenced to probation. He completed probation, anger management, counseling. He had no former contact with his girlfriend after the order, and he obtained an associate's degree in criminal justice. Because he was seeking a career in law enforcement, the stalking order, which prohibits possession of firearms, presented an obstacle for him. I filed a motion for Mr. Beeler with the court and served the former girlfriend. She didn't appear at the hearing. She didn't file objections. Clackamas County Judge Ken Stewart was sympathetic to the motion, but he felt obligated to deny it because there is no statutory procedure for review or dismissal of a stalking order. He encouraged me to present this issue to the Court of Appeals and to the legislature. The case is now pending before the Court of Appeals. The former girlfriend has not filed any response, and there will be oral argument set in July. The legislature has two remedies to protect people from unwanted or violent contact. You're probably familiar with Family Abuse Protection Act or FAPA orders. These require actual domestic violence or a serious imminent risk of domestic violence within 6 months of filing a petition. That also applies in cases of involuntary sexual relations. Once granted, this order applies for a year but can be renewed upon good cause. Stalking orders, however, do not require any domestic violence, only that there be two instances of repeated and unwanted contact, and that it is objectively reasonable for a person in the victim's situation to feel alarmed or coerced by the contact, and that the repeated and unwanted contact causes the victim reasonable apprehension regarding the personal safety of the victim or a member of the victim's immediate family or household. Like a FAPA order, a stalking order provides for absolutely no contact with a protected person at home, at work, in school, and within a geographic proximity to the person. In addition, the court may restrict the defendant's right, the respondent's right to possess firearms and ammunition or engage in activities involving firearms. Possession of firearms or ammunition is a federal felony, even with innocent intent and without any intention to have contact with a protected person. In Mr. Beeler's case and others, this can prevent employment in law enforcement, security, and other occupations. Unlike FAPA orders, which again are granted for far more serious conduct in many cases, stalking orders last forever. The reason I'm here is that there is no process for review of stalking orders. The purpose of this bill is then to provide a process whereby a stalking order can be reviewed by a court after notice to the protected person and the opportunity to have that order dismissed. After the bill was drafted, I consulted with Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center and Melissa Sidlick of the Oregon Judicial Department, and we have worked strongly together to address their concerns regarding the legislation. Together, we have come to a consensus on the following points, and these points are reflected in, you should have a separate document, a proposed amendment to SB 422. So our points of consensus are to establish a stalking order of definite duration. Right now, they are indefinite duration. That the presumption for a stalking order ought to be for 5 years, that a longer order can be entered upon a finding of good cause, that a person can seek renewal of a stalking order on grounds similar to those provided for renewal of FAPA orders. In the event of a timely filing for renewal, the existing stalking order should remain intact pending final resolution of the motion, and that a court can impose other requirements on a respondent to be satisfied before a request for dismissal. I want to make it clear that Ms. Hebb and others do oppose a safety valve, that is the opportunity to request a dismissal. However, if there is going to be a process for dismissal, we are then in agreement that the court can impose other conditions to grant the dismissal. So, where are we in disagreement? First, whether there ought to be a relief valve, that is a procedure to seek a dismissal before the expiration of the order. My amendment accomplishes this and may very well be ordered by the Court of Appeals in the current case. Second, whether the order can be a shorter duration than 5 years. Again, we have reached a consensus that upon good cause, a court can order an order of longer than 5 years. Third, whether the respondent should have a burden by a preponderance of the evidence, that's the current standard, 51%, or by clear and convincing evidence to obtain a dismissal. If the legislature is silent, presumably the court will use the general civil presumption, which is a preponderance. And whether a petitioner should have the opportunity to testify by telephone. I do want you to note that existing law permits telephone testimony in civil cases upon certain grounds. So I want to address with you the major issues, both of consensus and disagreement. Regarding the setting of a duration for a stalking order, the legislature needs to consider this case broadly in terms of what other states do and what
Oregon. Kramer, could I break in for half
sure.
a second? We have your written testimony as you back up
yes.
the points that you made. I think what I'd like to do is take the other people who are signed up, and we will. This will be part of the record, the rationale for the specifics that you mentioned. But we're getting a little short on time, and I want to make sure we hear everybody.
That's fine.
Bill.
Thank you, Chair Burdick.
Thank you very much.
Chair Burdick, Lord Grosser, I also am an attorney in private practice, and I very much join in my colleague remarks on this. The fine folks at the Oregon Law Center represent one end of the continuum of stalkers. Some stalkers are extraordinarily, frighteningly dangerous. But I think I am here because I've represented someone who was, unfortunately, just a socially inept individual who, inside a grocery store for a period of many months, was making what he thought were appreciated flirtatious remarks. He stared at the woman in what he considered to be a flirtatious and inviting manner. She found it terrifying, and after many, many months of saying absolutely nothing, this was inside the store, not asking security to say anything to him, she finally got a stalking protective order against him. He showed up in court thinking this was nothing at all. He didn't even recognize her name, didn't have a lawyer, although he could have afforded one. And the stalking order was entered without him really being given any opportunity, if you read the transcript, to express himself. It's now permanent. He is now unemployable. He is in the security area, and once you have a stalking protective order against you, it goes on both LADS and on OGIN, and OGIN's public record, and any prospective employer runs one's name, and this comes up, and he's unemployable. The collateral consequences are enormous, and we need to be mindful of the very dangerous people and the victims who are indeed victimized, but the people who are misunderstood, inarticulate people need some protection to be from being rendered permanently unemployable. One other point I'd like to make that isn't in my colleague's written testimony is there's a bit of a mystery in the statute, mystery to me anyway. 163.741 sub 1 says that once a stalking protective order is in place, it shall be placed on LEDS. Sub 3 says that it shall be removed from LEDS when the stalking protective order, quote, is terminated by order of the court. It sounds to me like at some point the legislation, when it was drafted, had a mechanism for terminating stalking protective orders, but it disappeared, leaving just this one odd little reference in 163.741 sub 3. So I... the other point I'd like to make that my colleague did make in his written testimony is it is very important to separate the socially inept from the truly dangerous, because one of the things that lumping those two categories of people together is it cheapens the stalking protective order. If simply inarticulate people can go into court and get them, it makes it seem like when you really do have a dangerous situation that a stalking protective order is not particularly of any consequence. And there can be absurd results, and this legislature last session dealt with one specific instance of an absurd result that it was solved piecemeal. Let to remind those of you that remember it, last year the Department of Corrections came in and said that an inmate had filed for a stalking protective order against all the guards because they were harassing him. So that's their job. And that one
they get paid for doing that
was our personal favorite on this committee.
Yeah. Those kinds of problems happen all the time. Those kinds of, not all the time, in this unusual category. It is. I have seen a number of absurd results, and I suggest they need not to be fixed piecemeal, but fixed in a larger way to give both a limited duration and then to have a mechanism with protection so that the a dangerous person can't use a legal system to continue to stalk, but to have a mechanism so that the inappropriate orders or the orders that were a misunderstanding between two people cannot ruin someone's life either forever or even for a period of 5 years.
Madam Chair.
What's it?
Madam Chair, who has the burden of proof that the victim need not continue to fear? The victim or the perpetrator?
At the time that the Senator Burdick and Senator Witt, at the time it's issued, the victim has the burden of proof by preponderance. And this hearing that we're proposing to exist, Now the person that's called a stalker would come in, and that person would have the burden to establish that the victim did not have reasonable ground to fear, and the judge would use their judicial powers to make that determination.
And that standard for getting rid of the stalking order would be clear and convincing, which is a step up from preponderance?
That's for this committee to decide. I would advocate for preponderance. That's the burden on the original getting it, so I would propose it should be the same on the other side. But
thank you.
Nothing
wrong. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Ms. Meyer.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Indeed, my testimony will be brief. The ACLU, and actually our lawyers committee a number of months ago, looked at this issue and is quite concerned with needing the policies and goals that Senate Bill 422 provides, which is a due process to which someone can then seek relief from a stalking order. And I think you've heard it well articulated already, and we do support the principles and goals set forth in this bill. Oh, and I need to add for the record, Chair Burdick, if I may, that I today at this moment get the opportunity to speak for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association as well, which also is supporting this, but I think Ms. Guy just thought she wouldn't layer up the table with too many folks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We're running out of time. Any more questions? Okay. Thank you. Now we will have Nancy Gluss, Sybil Hebb, and Gina Skinner.
Skinner?
I will be given for short testimony. Thank you.
That would be chocolate, would it?
Chocolate. Always chocolate. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Nancy Glass, co-director of the Center for Health Disparities Research at Oregon Health and Science University School of Nursing. I've been practicing clinically and conducting research in the area of violence against women, specifically intimate partner violence or domestic violence, for the past 12 years. I will be testifying against Senate Bill 422. I will focus my testimony today on stalking as a risk factor for intimate partner non-lethal and lethal violence. I will focus on women as the victims of stalking, although I recognize that men are also victims of stalking. Women disproportionately experience stalking as compared to men. Most often, the stalking of women is perpetrated by a male partner or ex-male partner. Further, the research findings I will briefly present today is from our national study of risk factors for attempted and actual femicides, or the murder of women. Our findings, which I will refer you to on page 3 and 4 of the written testimony, indicate that stalking behaviors preceded the majority, or 68%, of the 430 attempted and actual femicides that we reviewed nationally. most frequent type of stalking reported was being followed or spied upon, unwanted phone calls, or surveillance by a perpetrator from a car parked outside a woman's home or employment. Women who reported stalking behaviors by an intimate or ex-intimate partner were at nearly two-fold increase of actual or attempted femicide. What that means is women who were stalked in the year prior to their homicide had an odds of being, their odds of being murdered was increased 200%. Importantly, the vast majority of women victims, 83%, reported the perpetrator of the stalking behavior was a former partner. Our findings indicate a strong association between stalking and subsequent non-lethal and lethal violence. Additionally, our findings indicate that women separated from the partner were at greatest risk of stalking. Therefore, prior physical violence coupled with a former or estranged relationship plus stalking places women at greater danger of attempted or actual femicide.
Ms. Glass, if I could just break in here for a second. We're not really talking about the value of the stalking statute. We're really talking about whether there's any circumstances under which someone can petition and show evidence that the order should be rescinded. Do you have any data that shows that a stalking order needs to be permanent to be effective?
What we know is that research has indicated that the length of time that a woman was not in a relationship was the strongest predictor of increased stalking.
So the longer they've been apart,
out of the relationship, that was the strongest predictor of increased stalking for women. So separation, estrangement, a longer length of time out of the relationship since the relationship had ended predicted the stalking.
All right. Ms. Glass, or Dr. Glass, I'm having a hard time tracking this. If you have someone that's in a relationship, let's say, for 2 years, and that it ends on January 1st, 2005, mm-hmm. What I'm hearing you say, at least what I'm thinking I'm hearing you saying, the longer they're out of that relationship, the more likely there's going to be stalking occurring?
That's what the one study, there are very few studies nationally, but that is what one study indicates.
Can I ask you also, have you had a chance to look at the areas of consensus that Mr. Kramer identified?
I have, thank you, yes.
You have looked at that?
I have, Senator Burdick.
And do you agree on those? Are you part of that consensus?
I was not part of that consensus.
And so you're saying that you don't think any change should be made to the existing law?
I would, Senator, Madam Chair and Senators, I would caution changes before we hear from victims of stalking and more from the advocate community. I think that we need a lot more information at the state level about how the stalking orders are used and how they have impacted safety for women. So at this time, I would not like to see a change in the stalking orders.
Appreciate that very much, and I apologize for breaking in and dialing you down here. Sybil, did you want to go next?
Sure, thank you. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, Sybil Head for the Oregon Law Center, again in opposition to this bill and to the proposed amendments. I want to make it very clear that the Law Center does recognize that there is value in creating a mechanism to provide some limitation of stalking protective orders. We recognize that clearly there are circumstances when it may be inappropriate or unfair to have permanent orders in place, and so we're supportive of coming up with a mechanism that would address those concerns. We are concerned about the proposal that's written in the bill and the proposal that Mr. Kramer puts forward in his written testimony, because we don't think that it provides an adequate balance between notions of fairness, court efficiency, perpetrator accountability, and victim safety. And when looking at these issues, those are the values that we've been taking into account and trying to balance. As Ms. Glass indicated, stalking is a lethality indicator. It's a very serious set of behaviors, and so any attempt to modify the relief that's currently available under law should be done very carefully. And I think I'll actually echo Ms. Glazer's comments, which is that we shouldn't be doing anything in a piecemeal fashion with this protective order statute. And I think that we need, when we make any kind of significant change, to take into account the perspectives of judges and defense attorneys and prosecutors and advocates for victims and other groups as well, and to make sure that any change we make is considered. Specifically, I just want to speak to the proposal that Mr. Creamer made that there should be some mechanism for dismissal requests. And our concern about that is that when there has been a finding that a petitioner is in legitimate, reasonable fear for her personal safety, his or her personal safety, then that's a serious matter. And the whole purpose of the stalking protection order is to provide separation for those parties. If the respondent then has the ability to come back and ask for a dismissal, when the respondent is going to need to find the petitioner, serve the petitioner, the parties are going to have to come into court to relitigate facts that the court has already found, and there are safety implications for the victim in terms of being found. There are probably expense and convenience concerns, especially when victims have fled, to come back to court to relitigate this issue. We think that if there is to be an amendment to the stalking law, that there ought to be automatic termination dates, so that when the order is initially entered, both parties are clear how long it's going to last. It expires automatically after some reasonable period of time, and there could be renewal factors put into place if the petitioner needed to extend the order for any reason. So we're supportive of the idea of creating a mechanism. We have strong concerns from a victim safety standpoint about the proposals that have been put forward by Mr. Creamer. Again, I do appreciate his work. We have been trying to negotiate to come to an agreement over the past couple of months and just have not been able to do that. I do also want to draw the court's, the committee's attention to the fact that in 1995, there was testimony submitted in support of this set of bills that created this protective order statute. And a particular story that I found that was submitted as testimony was from a woman who was a reporter at KISN. And she had been stalked for the past 5 years by a perfect stranger who had interfered with her life and with her work and with her family and had caused significant disruption to her family and great fear for her safety. And so that particular set of circumstances, which had lasted over a period of 5 years by the time the testimony was presented, was on the committee's mind at the time we were considering this law. So I would just advocate that the committee not make any substantial changes to the statute without more considered a more considered look at the law. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, I want to go back to Ms. Glass for a moment. Ms. Glass, I wonder if you could provide the committee with the scope and the measure of statistical significance of the study that identified that increased duration of separation increased the danger of stalking. That just seems counterintuitive somehow. I wonder if you could do that for us.
I can direct you to the reference for that study. It was a large study, I believe, published in the year 2000, and I can get you more information about that study specifically.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We are opposed to Senate Bill 422 in its current form. I have been involved in prosecuting as a law clerk and as an attorney domestic violence cases for 10 years now, and have significantly spent a lot of time working on restraining order violation cases and stalking order violation cases. And you've already heard what the standards are and the distinctions between those two things, and those were accurately presented to this committee. The thing I would like to point out is that, anecdotally, what we see in court is a a significantly small number of stalking cases and stalking order violations compared to the number that we have of restraining orders. And looking at the cases that are presented, these are cases that are very, very serious. And the statutes contemplate that because they set out a procedure that is very onerous and very burdensome. And I would like the committee to consider that when thinking about reducing the duration of these orders. First of all, the petitioner has to go to a police officer and has to meet the burdens of probable cause, that there's this repeated unwanted contact, that it was alarming and coercing, that it was objectively reasonable for the person to have been alarmed or coerced, and that the victim is reasonably apprehensive regarding their personal safety. That has to be found. And then if the officer finds probable cause that that's true, then they submit an order and a petition to the court. And then both parties have to go in front of a judge, unlike a restraining order, which they can obtain ex parte, which means the petitioner can go in and get it on her own. There has to be a hearing. And so a hearing is set, which often takes up to several hours for testimony from both parties in front of a judge. And then a judge has to find on the preponderance and the evidence that that same standard has been met. When these orders go out, they are very serious, and we're talking about saving people's lives. Because of this complicated procedure and the kind of actions that we're looking at, it's also reflected in the consequences. If a restraining order is violated, the maximum sentence is 6 months in jail. And every time a restraining order is violated, it's continued to be 6 months in jail. That's the maximum sentence. In a stalking order, if it's violated one time, or if the person commits the crime of stalking, the sentence is an A misdemeanor. You can get up to a year in jail. And if you can be violated a second time, it's a level 8 on the sentencing guidelines. It's a felony, and it's presumptive prison for every single person that violates it. The law contemplates that these are very serious, and that the people that are getting them are serious, and the people that are violating them, that it is serious. And you heard testimony regarding the lethality. As a result, only the people that have these orders are the ones that truly deserve it. Stalking is by nature a crime where the people do not understand the word no. That's the point of being a stalker. They continue the behavior over and over and over again. And so that is the reason that we want these orders to be in effect for an extended period of time. The concerns that the association has with this bill is that, one, that it is that the one-year duration is far too short. We would agree that that it is reasonable for there be a procedure in place for these orders to be dismissed.
But you would be more in the line of 5 years.
5 years. Chair Burdick, 5 years is a reasonable standard.
Okay.
I would just say that one issue with the 5 years is whether that would be an automatic expiration or if that would be something that the respondent would need to petition the court after 5 years if they were still interested.
Okay, thank you. We are out of time for this bill, and I appreciate you all coming. I think I've been equally abrupt with everyone, so I hope I've been fair in that department. But right now I am going to close the hearing on this bill, and we will take it under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will now open a very quick work session on Senate Bill 94. Council, would you describe the bill and the -4 amendment? And I think we have Chief Tardif in the audience if we need him. Is that correct?
That's correct. And Una Swanson from DHS as well. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 94 is the bill that would modify the system that requires mandatory cross-reporting of child abuse reports between law enforcement agencies and the Department of Human Services. This bill was heard on the 31st of January, and at that time the concern of the committee was that it could be read to not require cross-reporting of every single report of child abuse. Our work group, including Craig Prinz from Criminal Justice, Ms. Swanson from DHS, and Chief Tardif from the Newburgh Police Department, met and actually met twice, and as a result of those meetings formulated what is before you in the -4 amendment. The -4 reinserts language that had originally been deleted from the bill to make clear that all reports of child abuse must be cross-reported between law enforcement and DHS. Section 2 of the -4 directs DHS to establish rules that would create a two-tier system of cross-reporting. One set of cross-reports would be required within or no later than 24 hours, and all all other reports of child abuse would be required to be cross-reported within 10 days and no later than 10 days after receipt. And the Dash 4 also makes clear that the rules that the agency is to promulgate are to establish how such notifications are to be made. The remainder of the bill is unchanged. The advisory committee that would establish these rules would be comprised of law enforcement, multidisciplinary teams, and other interested parties.
Thank you. Are there questions of anyone who's here or counsel? Senator Starr, have you had a chance to form an opinion on the Dash 4 amendment?
I favor the Dash 4 amendments, Madam Chair.
So would you like to accompany that with a motion? We are in work session.
I would move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 94.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 94. Is there questions, discussion, objection? Senator Walker, good fix.
Thanks.
So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 94 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 94 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections?
I would like
Senator
to just, I think I will support the bill now with those amendments. However, I am disturbed that the Department of Human Services has not really, in my opinion, followed the intent of the previous legislative direction rather than actually reporting appropriately. They have just apparently bundled a sheet of papers together and pitched it. And I, you know, I think that it should be on the record that we actually expect them to perform in prioritizing these reports in a two-tiered system and doing it according to the way it was suggested.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt, for those comments, and this will provide that clarity. So there are no objections, so ordered. Committee members, we started late today, and we've got to stop doing that, otherwise we're going to have night meetings. That's a threat. I'm going to carry that one. So if we could all try to be on time, I will do my very best to avoid extra hearings and meetings because we don't have time in our lives for them. Now I will move Senate Bill 1012 and Senate Bill 273 to the Wednesday meeting, and we are adjourned.
Okay, Charles.